All right, we're underway. Okay. By the way, I forgot to Josh and Irena news. I forgot to show you the latest Jerusalem Post cartoon of the week. Here is Mahmoud Abbas. Freeze all the settlements. No compromises or concessions. Jerusalem is ours. We won't recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Let all the refugees back. And here's Netanyahu. And here's Tzipi Livni, the Labor Party candidate, who's his rival. And she says, by the way, if these talks fail, it's all your fault. Yeah, that's what the world will say. That's what the world will say to him, too. The world will say, if these things fail, it's all Israel's fault. Well, that's a view of the so-called direct peace talks from an Israeli perspective. One perspective. Okay, chapter 11. Where were we in chapter 11? From verses 3 through 35, we were in the far future to Daniel's time during the Greek period, the third empire to impact the Jewish people during the times of the Gentiles, Hellenism, the Hellenistic Empire. When we got to verse 35, a big change occurred. From verses 3 through 35, we could follow what Daniel was predicting in secular history, right down the road. Secular history was easily illuminated, verses 3 through 35. But when we get to verse 36, something changes very dramatically. Well, the point of going down that Greek history from chapter 11, verse 3 through 35, is to get to this guy, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphany. Remember, he is the type of the Antichrist. He is the man who prefigures the Antichrist. He looks kind of harsh to me. He looks kind of like a brutal guy to me. But anyway, yeah, he isn't a monster, that's for sure. How many of you ladies think he's cute?
Got a bad picture.
Anyway, frowner. Yeah, he doesn't look like a happy person to me. Anyway, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphany, the precursor to the Antichrist. All right, as soon as we get into verse 36, history stops being fulfilled. From chapter 11, verse 36, through chapter 12, verse 1, what happens is we jump from the Greek period, from Antiochus Epiphany's day, into the tribulation period. We jump over our heads into the future, from the past to the future. Because history no longer is easily fulfilled here in verses 36 through chapter 12, verse 1. We can't coordinate what's told there with any Greek history that we know of. And even the liberal scholars admit that. Dr. Constable, in his notes, summed it up this way. He said, even liberal scholars who believe that a second century writer wrote the book as history rather than as prophecy admit that all of what follows has had no literal fulfillment in the past. So if they're writing history, why did they stop writing it at verse 35 and go into some kind of a story in verse 36? Well, it just doesn't hold water. So that's why we push this into the future. We who hold a literal, consistent literal interpretation say this belongs in the future and will be fulfilled then. Okay? I think that's my last. Yeah. All right, that brings us to the middle of page 286. Point three in the middle of the page. Now, when we started verse 36, we looked at the rise of the willful king, the Antichrist. At verse 37, we looked at the nature of the willful king. Remember, he will exalt himself above everything, above every man, above every woman, above every religion. But that doesn't mean he's an atheist. He does have a religion. And that's what we pick up on chapter 11, verse 38. Point three in the middle of your outline, the religion of the willful king. All right, everybody there? Verse 38? All right. But instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. All right, point 3a. In his place, he will honor a god of fortresses. The basic idea here is that he will worship power and might. Might and power. He'll follow the philosophy Point two, that might makes right. That's the philosophy of just about every dictator in history, right? If I have the gun, then I determine what's right and wrong. If I have the club, if I have the army, I determine what's right and wrong. You know, Susan and I went and saw, went up to Glendale and saw Camelot on Saturday, you know, with Honorable King Arthur. And what was his philosophy? He was going to start a new order of knighthood, of chivalry, where you use might for right, not might makes right. So a much more honorable goal. But the Antichrist is might makes right. Point B, furthermore, he's going to honor a God whom his fathers knew not. And the point there is that he will worship Satan directly. He'll be a direct Satan worshiper. And he'll honor Satan with gold, silver, precious stones, etc. And not even his pagan, idolatrous, polytheistic ancestors worship Satan directly. They had their idols. They had their gods and goddesses, their mythology. But no one that I know of worships Satan directly. Now, Satan worship is around, isn't it? Although it's kind of under wraps these days, it kind of rears its ugly head more and more, I think, as you read in the newspaper, you read about it here and there. It is around, but this guy is going to elevate it to very public prominence. He will be a Satan worshiper. All right, page 286. Let's go on to page 287. We've looked at the religion of the willful king. Page 287, we look at the policy of the willful king. Point two at the top of the page, verse 39. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god, and he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him and will cause them to rule over the many, and will parcel out land for a price. Now, in verse 39, I think there are actually two policies in view. The first policy is parentheses A. He will deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god. So policy number one is worldwide conquest. He's going to use his military power for worldwide conquest. And notice point one in your outline. His ability to conquer comes from receiving supernatural power from Satan. He worships Satan, and so Satan gives him the power to succeed. And this is brought out very clearly in the cross-references, cross-reference point two, 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 through 10. We will just read verses 8 and 9. 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 and 9. Then that lawless one, that's a reference to Antichrist, will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an early end by the appearance of his coming. That is, now he's described, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders. So you see here, the Antichrist is going to be intimately connected with Satan, and he's going to receive his power to be successful. Not only military power, but also supernatural power in the sense of signs and false wonders. So he's going to be a powerful being, a powerful guy. Also, Revelation 13, verses 1 through 8. Here's your second cross-reference. We'll read verses 1 and 2. And the dragon, of course a reference to Satan, that old dragon, stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Remember what the beast, the 10-headed beast, was? The final kingdom. Yeah, Rome or imperialism, whatever you want to call it. The unique beast, the composite beast. And you notice he has 10 horns. Those are 10 kingdoms. So the leaders of the beast are very much connected to it. And of course, the Antichrist will be the embodiment of the fourth kingdom. He will be the final dictator of the fourth kingdom. And again, the connection between him and Satan is brought out in this last phrase, last sentence. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So it appears that this guy is going to be indwelt by Satan. But his power will come from that close relationship with him. He worships Satan. He is empowered by Satan. Now, as I read that, what came to mind was the contrast between Antichrist and Yeshua, you know, the counterfeit Messiah and the real Messiah. And the contrast, for me, was illustrated in Matthew 4, verses 8 through 10. This is one of the temptations Yeshua went through, and I'm sure it's the same temptation the Antichrist is going to face. Again, the devil took him, and that's a reference to Jesus, took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. Well, that's what's offered to Antichrist, isn't it? You know, it was offered to Jesus. Here it is. Worldwide dominion. You can rule planet Earth. And I'm sure the same thing is going to be laid before the Antichrist. You can rule planet Earth. The goal of every dictator, you know, of Hitler, of Alexander the Great, more modern dictators as well, they want to rule the world. And it comes at a small price. Satan says to him, all these things I will give to you, because he is the prince of this world. He does have the authority to give it away. All these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me. What will Antichrist reply to that temptation? Bring it on, Satan! Down on his face. Boom! I want it. What was Jesus' reply to that temptation? Then Jesus said to him, go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. So the true Messiah, the genuine Messiah, totally committed to God his Father, the counterfeit Messiah will give in to this temptation. Quite a contrast, right? Of course, right. What a contrast. All right, that's the first policy of Antichrist, conquest, worldwide conquest. Second policy, point B. And this is directed that to those who acknowledge him. And that the idea there is those that confess him to be God, they will be rewarded for their loyalty. So that's his second policy, to reward the faithful for their loyalty in verse 39. So to them, he will increase their glory. In other words, he will elevate their status. He will give them honor. He will elevate their status. You will be the mayor of Irvine, Irvine, California, you know. You'll be the president of the United States, whatever. So he'll elevate their status. Secondly, he will cause them to rule over many. He'll elevate their position. So along with their honor comes their power, power to rule over the territory that he gives them. Honor and power, two huge temptations for human beings, right? Two huge temptations. That's what many men want, whether it be a little bit of honor and a little bit of power or a whole lot. Point three, the third part of his second policy, he shall divide the land for a price. So he's going to divide up his conquered territory and dole it out to his followers for their loyalty. And you know what this implies? This implies riches. If you are in charge of some territory, then you can extort out of that territory whatever riches you want. So ambition and greed is going to be the big temptation for most men. And those who follow him will be rewarded. Their ambitions, their selfish ambition, and their greed will be rewarded. That brings us to point four at the bottom of the page. You see 666, the mark of the beast. And let's take a look at the mark of the beast in Revelation 13, 16 through 18. So write that down beside the number 666. Revelation 13, verses 16 through 18. And we'll take a look at that. This is where it comes into play. Revelation 13, 16 through 18. For he causes all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand and their forehead. And he provides that no one will be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. So there it is, the very famous mark of the beast. What is it? Well, essentially, 666 is a mark of religious loyalty. A mark of religious loyalty. I kind of liken it to a counterfeit baptism. You know, in true baptism, you are proclaiming your loyalty to Yeshua. You're publicly proclaiming that you have placed your faith in Yeshua, right? Well, here, these people will be publicly proclaiming that they have placed their faith in Antichrist. Kind of like a counterfeit public profession of faith. Now note, this mark is the same for everyone. Everyone who takes it gets the same thing. It is not your social security number. It is not your credit card number or anything like that. Because if it was, it would be different for everyone. My social security number is different from your social security number. My credit card identifies me. It doesn't identify you. So this will be a mark that is the same for everyone. Again, it's a pledge of allegiance, a proclamation of faith in the Antichrist, and it is also the door to the world economic system. He will not allow you, you can't buy or sell without this mark. So we don't know what it'll be or what it'll look like. Maybe it'll be, like some people have suggested, a barcode. 666 and a barcode, and you'll stick it up on the scanner and you're in, right? But you don't have that mark. Well, just, you know, let me scan you in. Well, I don't have the mark. Well, sorry, I can't sell you that. You know, persecution will be gentle. It'll be easy. Just get the mark. And then you'll get your food or your water. You know? So it's going to be your entry into the world economic system. Now, the fact that this is a profession of faith in Antichrist is why those who take the mark are unsaved. Put down Revelation 14, 9 through 12 on your outline. Revelation 14, 9 through 12. Another cross-reference. Whoever receives the mark is unsaved. There's going to be no gray areas during the tribulation period. It's going to be black or white from the middle of the tribulation on. Black or white. Revelation 14, 9 through 12. Then another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, here's what happens. He also will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Rejecting the true Messiah, committing yourself to the counterfeit Messiah. That burns God up. And it's going to burn you up too, you know, if you're an unbeliever. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest, day or night. And those who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. And then here's the warning to those who read this in the tribulation period. The tribulation saints. Here's their encouragement. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. So that sentence at the end of verse 12 there is going to be a great encouragement to the tribulation saints who refuse the mark of the beast, because they are going to go through tremendous persecution. Many will die. A good number will survive the tribulation period, like the faithful remnant of Israel. but they are not in for a good time. It's going to be pretty tough. All right, I've got 7:30. Oh, I've got 15 more minutes. Excuse me, I don't want to send you on your break yet. All right, page 287. Let's move to page 288. Page 288. Now, at this point, and I will give you this slide next week. The morning class just about ripped my head off for not having this available. So you will have this available next week, okay? I want to review the four kingdoms of the times of the Gentiles so that we can put verse 40 in its proper place. All right, let's take a look up here at the screen. Remember the empires of the times of the Gentiles. We began with the Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar. That was defeated by the Medo-Persian Empire under Cyrus. In turn, Cyrus was defeated by the Hellenistic or Greek Empire under Alexander the Great. In turn, the Hellenistic Empire is defeated by the Fourth Empire, or we could call it Rome, we can call it imperialism, you know, whatever name we want to attach to it. We are in that empire today, because this empire will last until the setting up of the Messianic Kingdom. We are in the middle of it right now, and you'll see where in just a second. Now, the Fourth Empire is characterized by change. Okay, remember that? Yeah. Two legs. What was that all about?
Yeah.
And you're getting it, aren't you?
Yeah.
We are getting change. Okay. Anyway, remember the statue of the Fourth Empire, two legs that turned into ankles, into feet, into toes. Okay, change. That's what characterizes the Fourth Empire. Okay, here's the changes that it went through. Remember, we went through this a few lessons back. It begins in the United States with the Roman Empire, imperialism through conquest. That did not last very long. Rome could only get so big, so then she began to practice imperialism through influence, political and economic influence. The Roman Empire divided into two parts. It moved into the two-division stage, and we are in that two-division stage right now. It began with the Eastern Roman Empire and Western Roman Empire, and as the Roman Empire continued to expand, it's now seen in the East-West balance of power. We are in the Western branch of the East-West branch of balance of power. Russia and China and other nations are in the Eastern branch of the East-West balance of power. And this balance of power goes back and forth between East and West, and someday it will break down. So I did this point B in gold because this is where we're at. We're in the two-division stage today. This two-division stage will give way to, guess what? The one-world government stage, right? What do we hear in the news all the time now? One-world government, one currency, one this, one that. Because mankind thinks that that's going to be the ideal government for this planet. Well, the Roman Empire will go into the one-world government stage, but we'll find out that that's not going to work too well. And so the next change will come. We will change to the 10-division stage. The Roman Empire will eventually turn to the 10-division stage. That's the 10 toes and the 10 horns. The 10 horns of the beast, the 10 toes of the statue. And this is where verse 40 fits. Verse 40 is a description of Antichrist's war against the 10 kings. That's where verse 40 fits in. Let's take a look at that. Remember back in chapter 7, we got a glimpse of the 10-division stage. Daniel 7, verses 7 and 8. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. There he is, Rome, imperialism. Dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that went before. So there's Rome and imperialism. And guess what it had? It had 10 horns. That's a picture of the 10-division stage. While I was contemplating the 10 horns, behold, another horn, a little one, that's a reference to Antichrist, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by their roots before it. We'll get a look at who those horns are in just a minute. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. And then we drop down to verses 19 and 20. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and the meaning of the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. Daniel gets his answer. The angel says to him, "Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, imperialism, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it." In other words, Rome or imperialism is going to go worldwide. Remember, we don't need a revived Roman Empire. It never died. It never needed to be revived. It is simply changed form and spread around the world. And we're part of it. We're in the middle of that right now. So don't worry about a revived Roman Empire in Europe or whatever. Okay, it's a worldwide government. Okay? It devours the whole earth, treads it down, and crushes it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise. There's your ten division stage. The horns or the toes. And another, that's a reference to Antichrist, will arise after them. And he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue three kings. So as we get back to verse 40, again, we're going to look at Antichrist's war against the ten kings, and he will be successful. And then we come to the final stage of the Roman Empire, the Antichrist stage, the final change. Okay, does that make sense? All right, I will give you slides of all this next week. Okay, there's our review. Now, let's dive into verse 40. Chapter 11, verse 40. We look at the conquests of the Antichrist, and his domination really reaches its peak in the middle of the tribulation period. The war in the middle of the tribulation. Verse 40. At the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. And he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. First phrase, point A, at the time of the end, point A1. This is the same phrase we encountered back in verse 35, indicating a transition into the future. Same phrase, at the time of the end. Notice the breakdown, point A and B, verses 36 through 39, describe the general policy and practices of Antichrist. But now we kind of change subjects in verses 40 through 45, and his specific activities are detailed. His specific activities. And all of this, point two, all of this points to the beginning of the second half of the tribulation when Antichrist gains full political and religious control of the world. And he will get it through a war. Now, the ones he wars against, his enemies, are brought out in point B, second part of verse 40. First of all, the king of the south. Now that is going to be Egypt. The king of the south will contend with him, and we're interpreting that as Egypt because this is consistent with the usage of that terminology throughout chapter 11. The king of the south is always Egypt. Now this might be one point. It might be one point of a continental union here, because we'll see that this will give Antichrist access to all of Africa in just a minute. Okay, so that's the king of the south, Egypt. The other enemy, point two, the king of the north. Again, consistent with chapter 11, we're going to interpret that as being Syria. And again, this might be the point of another continental union coming here. So the king of the north might command much more territory than Syria, just as the king of the south might command much more territory than Egypt. All right, so we learn in point two that the king of the north and the south shall come against Antichrist like a windstorm, like a whirlwind. So suddenly and fiercely they will attack him. And point C, I don't believe the word should be armor there. I believe the word should be army. So I would cross it out and say the army or his military force, which is both army and navy. He's going to be attacked by chariots and horsemen. That would be his army. And ships of war. That would be the navy of the king of the north and the king of the south. So they're going to come against Antichrist. Will they succeed in defeating him? If you want to find out that answer, turn to page 289. The answer to that is on page 289, the top of the page. Of course, we've already read it in verse 40. Point C, the top of the page, he will defeat his opposition. He will enter into the countries. He shall overflow and pass through. Underline that word, overflow. It's the picture of a flood. It's the picture of a river overflowing its banks and flooding the territory all around it. And the figure of a flood is a consistent symbol of a military invasion in Scripture, point B. Consistent symbol of a military invasion. So Antichrist will defeat these enemies. In fact, he will enter into their territory and overflow them. Well, he'll probably get his armies from the territories that he commands to begin with. Okay, here he goes worldwide in scope. So he's going to have some authority before he uproots these kings. So that's all we can say is that he has military power provided him by Satan in order to accomplish this. Okay? That's about all we can say. He does have an army, and he does get it. He has it organized before this battle. Yes? Well, the location of the Antichrist will be Israel. We'll see that in just a second. But this is not quite the campaign of Armageddon. The campaign of Armageddon will follow this in just a second. Okay? Question?
So at this point, he's just one of the 10 kings?
No, he's not any of the 10 kings. He is uprooting 3 of them. Okay? He's in the process now of uprooting 3. And we'll take a look at that in just a second. Okay? All righty, I've got 2 minutes. Let's see. Verse 41, the first part of verse 41. That details the fall of Israel in the middle of the tribulation. The fall of Israel will follow this war. First part of verse 41. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall. All right, we've run across that terminology for Israel in the past, the glorious land or the beautiful land. There it is, right at the point between Syria and Egypt, between perhaps one continental union and another. So in the middle of the tribulation, we know that the modern state of Israel will collapse. And so this reference is the same as the Gentile takeover in Revelation chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. Here's Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2. Then there was given me a measuring rod, and John is speaking here. He was given to me a measuring rod like a staff, and someone said, "Get up and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it. Leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the nations, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. And that's 3.5 years. And this is also brought out by Jesus in Luke chapter 21:24. Write that down as a cross-reference. In this verse, he also defines the times of the Gentiles. Talking of the Jewish people, they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive into all the nations. That's the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Jerusalem will fall again in the middle of the tribulation. The modern state of Israel will collapse in the middle of the tribulation period. And again, Zechariah 14, 1 and 2, another cross reference for you to write down there. Zechariah 14, verses 1 and 2. Again, the fall of Jerusalem in the middle of the tribulation period. Behold, a day is coming, for the Lord when the spoil will be taken from you and will be divided among you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled. But the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. So another description of Jerusalem's fall in the middle of the tribulation period. So this war against the kings of the north and the south, point C, will set up the stage for the abomination of desolation. We have this war that's followed by the abomination of desolation. Remember, we've seen that on a number of occasions. Daniel 9:27. He will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. Antichrist will make a 7-year covenant with Israel. But what will happen in the middle of that week? In the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. He will violate his covenant. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. So Daniel 9:27 is the verse that gives us the title for the abomination of desolation. It provides the two terms. Something abominable is going to happen in the temple. Matthew 24:15, point C2 in your outline. Jesus refers to the abomination in chapter 24. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. The reader, especially the Jewish reader of this verse, needs to understand something. What does he need to understand? He needs to understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go back to get his things that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. The reader of that verse needs to understand that if you see the abomination of desolation, the Antichrist Holocaust has begun, get out of town as quickly as you can. You don't have a second to spare, literally. I believe they happen after the middle of the tribulation. I'd have to check that. Okay. Now let me hit one more cross-reference for you, and I'll turn you loose for your break. 2 Thessalonians 2, 3, and 4. Again, the reference to the abomination of desolation. Remember this verse? Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. So he rejects every religious system except himself. And something very abominable happens in the tribulation temple. All right, that brings us to the middle of verse 41 and point 3 in your outline. So go ahead and take your break. And right about 8 o'clock, in about 10 minutes, listen for the shofar, and we'll come back and finish up chapter 11. All right. We'll pick it up in the middle of verse 41. We're at point 3 in the middle of the page. Page 289. So he's going to enter the glorious land. And then in chapter 11, verse 41, the second part of the verse, we get a glimpse of those who escape. Those who escape. Who are they, and why do they escape? Verse 41, second part of the verse. Everybody there okay? Verse 41, second part of the verse. But, here's the contrast, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Thank you, Steve. So many countries are going to be overthrown by Antichrist. He's going to succeed in a political takeover of the entire world, point 3a. But there are some countries that are going to escape out of his hand. And the nations that escape his domination are listed as Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And here's Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Ammon is to the north of the... All, of course, are to the east side of the Jordan River. Ammon to the north of the Dead Sea, approximately. Moab opposite the Dead Sea. And Edom to the south of the Dead Sea. Those are the approximate borders of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. All of these nations fall in the modern nation of Jordan today. Edom is southern Jordan, Moab is central Jordan, Ammon is northern Jordan. So Jordan somehow will be delivered from the domination of the Antichrist. How? Doesn't say. Why Jordan is delivered is because there needs to be a refuge for the Jewish people. God always provides a refuge for the Jewish people. All right, turn to page 290. 290. Is that why the Jordanians are nice to the Israelis? They're not nice to the Israelis. Well, that's true. They've always been pragmatic. When the wind is blowing, you know, in the Arab direction, they go with the Arabs. When the wind is blowing in the Israeli direction, so. Yeah, they haven't been quite as mean, and they have a so-called peace treaty with Israel today. Okay, remember now, we've got the war in the middle of the tribulation that brings the Antichrist to power. Then we'll have the campaign of Armageddon in which Jerusalem will fall and the abomination of desolation will be set up. And page 290, point C at the top of the page, the abomination of desolation sets the stage for Israel's flight out of the land. Again, this is the fall of the modern state of Israel in the middle of the tribulation. And the takeover of Israel causes the flight. Again, Matthew 24, we're familiar with this, remember? But we're going to expand on this section of Scripture a little bit. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. And here's what they've got to understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. They need to go to the mountains somewhere. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things that are in his house. Whoever's in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. So it's going to be, this flight of Israel is going to be especially difficult on pregnant and nursing women. Can you imagine being 7, 8, 9 months pregnant and have to flee the land as quickly as you can? Or you're with your little 6-month-old, 2-month-old? Man, that's going to be hard. Woe to those who are pregnant and who are nursing babies. But pray. Pray that your flight will not be in winter when the weather's rotten and you have wadis washing out the roads and a miserable weather, because they're going to flee. Don't even go back and get your cloak, okay, and the weather's horrible. So pray that it not be on Shabbat. On Shabbat, transportation shuts down in Israel. It's hard to get out of town if you're dependent on the Agat bus system, okay? So pray. If you pray for Israel, pray that the that the abomination of desolation doesn't happen in winter on Sabbath. Okay? For there will be a great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now or ever will. Unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. If this had been allowed to go to its bitter end, planet Earth would be lifeless. But because they're going to be believers in the tribulation period, God is going to cut it short. All right, that is the flight of Israel. Israel has to flee into the mountain somewhere. That's the warning. And so point two, the freedom of the Transjordanian territory provides the place of escape for the Jewish people. This will be a refuge. This is brought out in Micah 2:12. Here's Micah 2:12. I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep in the fold. It would be better to translate that as a proper noun. I will put them together like sheep in Bozra, also known as Petra. Like a flock in the midst of the pasture, they will be noisy with men. This is also brought out in Revelation chapter 12, verse 6, your second cross-reference, and verses 13 and 14. Revelation 12, 6. Then the woman, and remember this is a symbolic presentation going on in chapter 12. Then the woman, portraying Israel, fled into what? Into the wilderness. So the Jewish people have to flee to a place that is mountainous and in the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she would be nourished for 1,260 days, 3.5 years. There is a place prepared for God for the Jewish people. A refuge in the mountains and in the wilderness. Dropping down to verses 13 and 14 of Revelation 12. When the dragon, portraying Satan, saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman. Again, that's a portrayal of Israel, who gave birth to the male child, a reference to Jesus. But the two wings of a great eagle were given to the woman so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place, where she was nourished for a time, times and half a time, 3.5 years, from the presence of the serpent. So again, a reference to the fact that the Jewish people will, or I should say, this most important segment of the Jewish people will have a place of refuge. And that place of refuge is Petra or Bozra, and Petra or Bozra is located in southern Jordan today. There's where it's located. Southern Jordan. It is located in the Mount Seir mountain range. Right here, this is the Mount Seir mountain range. I'll show you a picture of it. And so this is the fifth stage of the campaign of Armageddon. The fifth stage of the campaign of Armageddon is the tribulation holocaust and the Jewish flight to Bozrah or Petra. So the Antichrist will set up the abomination of desolation. Those that heed the warning in the book of Matthew will flee. They will flee to southern Jordan, to Bozrah or Petra. That's the Jewish flight to Bozrah, located in the Mount Seir mountain range. I don't have a picture that I took of myself of the Mount Seir mountain range. When I was down there, I didn't have a very good camera, so I just bought a postcard, and I scanned the postcard in. This is Aqaba. This is the Jordanian town of Aqaba at the base of the Mount Seir mountain range, and this is just a small snippet of it, just a little bit of it here. But you can see it is a desolate place. It is the wilderness, and it is the mountains. Now, located in the middle of the Mount Seir mountain range is Bozrah or Petra. The main entry into Bozrah or Petra is the Sick. The Sick is a mile-long, twisting cleft in the rock. And Josh has been there. Here is a picture taken by Josh. I have not been there yet. And here the tourists are heading down, heading down the Sick. You guys have? I'm jealous. I'm jealous of all of you. Okay, bring back memories. Bring back memories. Okay. So here's tourists heading down the Sick. Again, a very narrow, twisting cleft in the rock, very defensible. A dozen soldiers could hold off an army of 1 million men right here. Very, very defensible. As you get toward the end of it, Petra or Basra begins to come into view. You see some kind of a building off in the distance. And as you get closer, coming toward the end of the sick now, and you walk out of the sick, and you're face to face with the treasury. A magnificent building carved out of the red sandstone cliff directly in front of you. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah, if you saw that movie, it was filmed right here. The Nabataeans did this. The Nabataeans, this used to be their capital city, and they carved a lot of it out of the rock. Now, we're going to stand between those pillars and turn around in just a moment. Here's another close-up that Josh took. Now, let's stand between those two pillars and turn around. And when you do, there's the sick. There's the entrance that you just came out of. See that cleft in the rock? It's as though God just split it apart there with an earthquake. So there's the main entrance into Petra. Now, here is the same location from the air. It doesn't look quite as impressive from the air, does it? Here is the sick, right here, the shadow. There, those little ants, there, the tourists. And that is the treasury. That is the treasury. So let me show it for you guys here. The sick right there, the tourists right there, and the treasury right there. And this is the main road into Basra. That's the main road into Petra. So here's the main road into Petra, right in through here. Now here is another view of the treasury. And this area is being excavated by the Jordanian Archaeological Society because this area is covered in 5 feet of debris. And so the actual pavement is 5 feet below that. So when that gets all excavated, the treasury is even going to seem more impressive because you're going to even be 5 feet lower. So maybe when it gets excavated, I'll get to go there. Who knows? And here are some of the tombs and buildings that have been carved out of the Mount Seir mountain range. You can see them all along the mountain here. And there, this is one of the more impressive buildings carved out. But Petra or Basra is quite an extensive place. Not everything was carved out of the Mount Seir mountain range. There were many independent buildings and farmlands, and there's water even gets piped in there. So it will be able to sustain people for 3.5 years. It will be able to do that. Did I see a question? Yes, Bonnie.
If there are Gentiles who come to Christ,
yes.
After Mitzvah, are they going to be there with the Jewish people?
No, probably not. This will be the location of the most important body of Jewish people, probably the leaders of the nation of Israel. But no, this is where the Jewish people will flee. Now, I'm not going to say that's exclusive. There might be some Gentiles who join them. I don't know. But basically, this place will be teeming with Jewish people. That's the kingdom. You're a little bit, that's in the kingdom. Okay. One more question? Yes.
How old
did you say these buildings were built during the Nabataean time, which would be in the intertestamental period, a couple hundred years B.C., maybe a little bit before then. Okay, this was the capital of the Nabataean kingdom at one time. It was their capital city, a main trading route, it was a big deal at one time. Oh, yeah. Kind of makes Mount Rushmore look pale by comparison, yeah. Yeah. All right, well, let's move on. Oh, wait, one more question.
So do the Jewish people read this and believe this? And
not today. Not today. Not today, no. There have been some Christians in the past who have stocked some of the caves here with Bibles, but they've all been destroyed by the Bedouins. The Bedouins all got into them and tore them all apart and sold them, you know. So Christians have tried to prepare the place, but the Jews... Hmm? Jordan, it's just a big tourist center now. It's been developed for tourism. There's a number of hotels outside the Sick, and you can go in there. As you can see from Josh's picture, all the tourists walking down there. The Israelis love this place. They're fascinated with it. And there are pointers to Petra in Israel, but we won't cover that right now. Roughly, probably about 80 at the most, down and over, maybe 80 at the most. You can drive down the main road along the Jordan Valley. It just takes a short time to get down there to the marker. There's a marker pointing to Petra on the main road. It's amazing. But yeah, the Jewish people don't believe in the Bible today. They don't read the New Testament. But they will know when the time comes. We'll see what happens. Huh? Through the 144,000? Sure. Through the work we do today, our witness to Israel today is preparing the Jewish community for all this. So we may be, you know, we may be a few years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 100 years, who knows? We're ahead of that time, but the work we're doing now, witnessing to your Jewish friend, etc., is preparing the Jewish community for this flight to Basra. Don't doubt it for a minute. Okay? Don't doubt it for a minute. Okay? All righty. So there will be a place of refuge for the Jewish people. Let's move on to point four in the middle of page 290, the fall of Egypt. The fall of Egypt. Here comes that third king. Or one of the kings, I should say. The fall of Egypt, verses 42 and 43. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. So one nation will escape, Jordan. We don't know how Jordan will be rescued, but all the other nations will not. And point B, the land of Egypt will not escape. So this is the first of the three kings to be subdued and killed. Remember, he has to uproot three kings. And then he will spoil Egypt. Point C, he shall have power over all the treasures of gold and silver and the precious things of Egypt. So whatever is of value in Egypt is confiscated, plundered, by the Antichrist. And believe me, Egypt has gold and silver and plunder. There's, I don't know if that's Tutankhamun's. I don't know, that's some pharaoh's golden sarcophagus there. And what about this? Look at that, Nefertiti's bust. Yeah, bust, the Nefertiti. Look at that beautiful piece of artwork. He'll confiscate it. No, he'll take it for his own use, his own riches. Yeah, sell it on eBay, right? Yeah, Hitler did the same thing with art. Sure, he did the same thing with European art. He confiscated it for himself. So this guy is going to plunder Egypt. So here's a map. There's modern Egypt. And so he will, first of all, conquer Egypt. And then, it says, Libya will fall to him. And Libya is, as it was in ancient times, to the west of Egypt. Little different, wasn't quite as big as the boundaries we have now, but Libya was to the west of Egypt, so he'll conquer Libya, and then he will conquer Ethiopia. Biblical Ethiopia is not modern Ethiopia, but the Sudan, and there's the Sudan right below Egypt. So he will conquer those two areas, and that means the door is open to conquering all of Africa. So this may be one of the continental unions. Africa may be one of the continental unions, and apparently this is the doorway into conquering all of Africa. Because remember, he's going to go worldwide. So when he defeats the king of Egypt, perhaps the leader of a continental union, he will now have access to all of Africa. So all his competitors to the south are going to be subdued. And again, remember, he's got satanic power to do this. Page 291, we come to verse 44, and the fall of Syria and Mesopotamia. Verse 44. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. Tidings out of the east trouble him. Now, in the Bible, the east is always Mesopotamia, point one. Many people extend it all the way to China, but I don't think that fits the context here. The east would be Mesopotamia, and today that would be Iraq, and perhaps Iran, and maybe this is a corner of a continental union coming down. It's not likely that it will include China. So this might be another corner of a continental union. We might have three continental unions meet right in this area. It wouldn't surprise me if that's the case at all. So this is the second of three kings to fall. Second of three kings to be subdued or killed. And it makes more sense if these guys are leaders of more than just Iraq, but perhaps of a continental union. All right, then, point B, tidings out of the north trouble him. Now, the north is Syria in chapter 11. So it's point two says, in this context, it cannot be Russia, unless this is the point of another continental union coming down, unless the leader of Syria is much more than the leader of Syria. So it's possible, I don't agree with that statement in its entirety. I would not assume that this includes Russia, but it is a possibility that it could be a third continental union coming down here. We'll have to see how the UN, the United Nothing, divides everything up, how the world goes when that 10-nation worldwide government is set up. But anyway, this is the third of the three kings to be killed, the third of the three kings to be beaten or subdued. So point C, he shall go forth with great fury, because of tidings from the north and east. So he'll be attacked by their combined forces, forces from the north and east, to destroy and sweep away many. And both of those kings will be killed. They will not succeed in defeating the Antichrist. He will be empowered by Satan, and he will have victory over these kings. Now, we've seen three points of the compass brought out. And these three points of the compass only make sense if the Antichrist is located in Israel. We have the king of the south, and that's Egypt. That's south of Israel. We have the king of the east, and Iraq and Iran points east, to the east of Israel. And we have the king of the north, which again is Syria. So this indicates to us that the Antichrist will have his headquarters in Israel. So let's turn to page 292. Question.
Could it be possible that the reference is just as if he's in Israel, but he's not? In other words, it's from a Jewish perspective.
Well, we know that Babylon, let's see, is it located here? Babylon down in Iraq. It's not on the modern map there. Babylon will become his capital of the world, but the campaign of Armageddon starts from the Jezreel Valley. And in the campaign of Armageddon, the first step is the gathering of the nations to the Jezreel Valley. The second stage is the Antichrist moving from his capital, Babylon, to the Jezreel Valley, joining his troops. Then Babylon is destroyed. So, he apparently spends some time in Israel. Perhaps that's part of the Treaty of Peace. Maybe he's defending Israel. Who knows? Or at least appearing to defend Israel. The details are not given to us. We'll have to watch from heaven and see how it comes about. Will we have a gigantic HD TV up in the kingdom? Watch all this happening. And now... Yeah, and now Gabriel. We'll switch over to Gabriel in Jezreel Valley, and now down to Angel B in the Jordan Valley. What do you see down there, Angel B? Well, I see the forces of the Antichrist coming in. Who knows what it'll be like? Okay. All right. Enough of this. So, yes. Heavenly directed TV. Okay. All right. Good for Bonnie. All right. The headquarters in Jerusalem. Verse 45, first part of verse 45. He will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Now, this term tent is a military term, the tent of a general, but it's also called a royal pavilion or a palace, and some kind of a royal tent is erected. So his palace here is a military tent. He is going to lead his army in style. Now, the location of this headquarters for the, it'll be the campaign of Armageddon, will be between the seas. And point 2A and B, the seas would be the, first of all, to the west, the Mediterranean Sea, and to the east, it'll be the Dead Sea. So we have two seas there. And point C says, at the glorious holy mountain. So that, of course, is a reference to Jerusalem, located right between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. That's where he'll eventually set up his palace tent, and it will probably be on the Temple Mount. Probably on the Temple Mount. Now, here's the Temple Mount today, and it houses the Dome of the Rock rather than the Jewish temple. But someone very skillfully photoshopped a model of the temple over the top of the Dome of the Rock. So here's your view from the Mount of Olives. Here's the Kidron Valley in front of you and the Temple Mount. And look at that, there's a temple sitting on it. So I kind of like that picture with modern Jerusalem in the background. So the wonders you can do with Photoshop. But the temple will be up and functioning by the middle of the tribulation period. So apparently he will set up his headquarters when he gets to Jerusalem up on the Temple Mount somewhere. And that's supported by Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2. Then there was given me a measuring rod and a staff, and someone said, get up and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it. Leave out the court which is outside the temple and do not measure it, for it has been given to the nations, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles is complete. So the modern state of Israel will collapse, Jerusalem will collapse, and the Antichrist will be there setting up his headquarters, probably on the Temple Mount, and committing the abomination of desolation, point three. And again, that's 2 Thessalonians 2:4. He takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God, an abominable act. And finally, again, all this marks the flight of Israel in Matthew 24. When you see the abomination of desolation, flee to the mountains, flee to the wilderness. Now, in the middle of the tribulation, a very amazing event occurs, the death of the Antichrist. Second part of verse 45. Second part of verse 45. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. And since our context here is the middle of the tribulation, I think this refers to the death of the Antichrist in the middle of the tribulation period. Point B, Antichrist is killed in the middle of the tribulation in the war against the three kings, but point C, he will be resurrected by Satan. Not everyone agrees that he'll be resurrected. They don't want to give Satan that much power, but looking at Revelation chapter 13, verse 3, verse 12, and verse 14, I'm convinced that he does die. Let's take a look at Revelation 13, 3. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound, was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. Now that word for fatal wound in chapter 13, verse 3, means to be slaughtered by the cutting of the throat. To be slaughtered by cutting the throat. So Antichrist apparently will be assassinated. He'll have his throat slit. Now, how were sacrifices slaughtered? The throat is slit. Okay? Hang on to that thought. Let's go on. Revelation 13, 12. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. Another consistent statement. And finally, verse 14, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which was given to him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who had what? The wound of the sword and has come to life. He has his throat slit. And so here, the counterfeit Messiah is assassinated, but then he is resurrected after this assassination, and then he is presented as a sacrifice. So the false Messiah, the counterfeit Messiah, is trying to counterfeit what Jesus was. Jesus was the true sacrificial lamb who died for our sins on the cross, was resurrected. Here, Antichrist is trying his best to counterfeit that. But he doesn't get it quite right. Exactly. He can't duplicate it. But he's going to be presented as a sacrifice. A sacrifice. Yes, a couple of questions.
When Jesus comes back, does he kill the Antichrist, or does he just throw him in the lake of fire at that time?
No, he kills him, and then
he dies again.
Yes, he will die again and be tossed, and then his soul is tossed into the lake of fire, yeah. Okay. Well, he's resurrected and tossed into the lake of fire right at the beginning there. Okay, verse, any other questions? Yes, one more.
So this is an appearance of resurrection out of the grave.
No, there's a difference. There's a difference between being raised from the dead and being resurrected.
Well, there's a difference between, yes, resurrection power, resurrection life, and resuscitation to natural life. Okay, Jairus' daughter was resurrected, resuscitated to natural life. Right. So was Lazarus. They died again. That's what's happening here. This is not a resurrection to true resurrection life. Okay, there's a difference, okay? All righty, you guys. Well, we made it. That brings us to chapter 12, and we'll pick it up next week at chapter 12. I've only kept you 2 minutes over here, even though you got a shorter break and all that, so you can't be too mad at me. All righty, let's go ahead and close in prayer, and I'll turn you loose. Father, again, we want to thank you for this section of your word. Quite an amazing section, Lord, that kind of bowls me over when I think of the implications of all this. But we know the future now. You've given us a glimpse into the tribulation period and all that's going to happen. And so give us the opportunity now that we know what's going to happen to warn those around us, Jew and Gentile alike, to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. Because the Jewish people need to know that there's a place of refuge to flee to. They need to know when to flee. And the world around us needs to know that they're not to take the mark of the beast. And we don't know how soon that's going to happen. We see the puzzle pieces slowly, steadily moving into place. So Lord, help us to be ready to share all this information with those around us, even if they find it incredible, because we know that those whom you are calling to salvation will heed the message. So help us to find them. Help us to reach out to them in the power of your Spirit. We ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you guys next week.